Hello, and welcome to Talking About Tumors with Ryan and Ryan. I'm Ryan Holstead.
And I'm Ryan Quinn.
And this is our first episode on metastatic colon cancer, an overview of management and the fundamentals of systemic therapy.
Now, for those of you who didn't listen to our introductory episode or introduction to our podcast, this is a podcast geared towards oncology trainees, so internal medicine residents interested in oncology or oncology fellows.
And our hope is to go over individual tumor sites in short 20 to 30 minute episodes, trying to cover all the things that you need to do to approach these patients for the first time in the clinic, as well as the backgrounds from a medical oncology standpoint for our standard of care treatment that we use today. So our first episodes will be on colon cancer, and we're going to talk initially about just the general background of metastatic colon cancer, followed up by some of the newer targeted agents, and then we'll move into localized therapy.
Colon cancer is a pretty bread and butter topic for oncology. It's the third most common cancer in men and women, so you'll see it very frequently in clinic.
This disease can have quite variable presentations, and you will see patients coming to clinic in many different ways. They may be asymptomatic, just having found metastatic disease at the time of staging for a new localized disease. They may have recurrence at the time of during surveillance imaging. This disease may be solitary and just involving a few hepatic nodules, or might be much more pronounced, and people can have obstruction if the disease is involving the colon. They may be presenting with severe hematochezia and anemia requiring hospitalization. And in those sorts of patients, we might even have to manage the presenting symptoms prior to even talking about how to deal with this from a chemotherapy standpoint. And some patients might even present with the worst overall, which would be peritoneal disease, which portends the worst prognosis.
So we'll get more into staging when we talk about localized colon cancer in the next episode. But for our purposes for today, metastatic colon cancer is all considered stage 4. 4A is metastatic colon cancer with just one site of metastasis. 4B is two sites. And then 4C is peritoneal disease, which portends the worst prognosis.
All right. So briefly on the approach to a patient, let's say a patient comes into your clinic. They have a colonic mass. They get imaged with a CT scan, which shows some liver lesions. You know, what are the first steps that we would do there?
So as with all cancers, we want a biopsy to confirm the diagnosis. So we typically want to get a metastatic disease site and biopsy that site to make sure that it is metastatic colon cancer. When you look at the pathology report, you'll classically see colon adenocarcinoma, which is the most common. And it's CK7 negative and CK20 positive.
Yeah, and that CK7 negative and CK20 positive are those histological stains that our pathologists report out. And this is relevant because sometimes you'll just see a hepatic mass and it'll be adenocarcinoma. And the question is, where did it begin? Because where it began will determine how we treat. And that pattern is very unique for colon cancer and will help differentiate from some of the other cancers we'll talk about later.
So for staging imaging, we typically get a CAT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis. In the US, we love our PET CTs. However, there's kind of a limited role for PET CT in metastatic colon cancer. Liver or MRI is more relevant. So as we know in CT scans of the abdomen, sometimes liver lesions are difficult to tell what they are. So getting an MRI of the liver may help clarify if it's metastatic disease versus a cyst or hemangioma.
When the disease is limited, what we would call oligometastatic disease, so just involving one site or two sites, usually we'll see this in the liver. The first thought is, can we treat this surgically? So in colon cancer, there is long-term survival benefits for patients with minimum disease who have the entirety of the disease resected. So they may have their primary tumor in the colon resected, followed by the liver lesion resected. This is not the case with all cancers, but it's important to know and often ends up being a common discussion during our tumor board multidisciplinary meetings.
This is a high-yield topic that could appear as a board question. You'll see a patient that has a very good performance status with a colon mass and just one mass in the liver or a few masses just in one lobe of the liver. And for these patients, the choice will be to resect the liver mass as well as the colon mass because outcomes in these patients can be good and you can achieve cure in some of these patients.
Let's say the patient has more extensive disease though, or they're not a surgical candidate. Then we're going to be talking primarily that this is a chemotherapy-based treatment. The first question you would ask yourself before treating these patients are they able to tolerate chemotherapy? And we typically use the ECOG status as our litmus test in medical oncology.
So when we're talking about performance status, us oncologists love the term performance status, but what does that really mean? There are many different scales to determine a patient's performance status. Probably the most commonly used is the ECOG performance status. So it's the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group performance status scale, and it goes from 0 to 5. So 0 is a patient that's functioning normally, can work out at the gym, you know, do their normal activities. 1 is someone who cannot really do any physically strenuous activity, but still able to work, you know, they can do their normal job. So ECOG of 2 is someone who is up out of bed greater than 50% of the time, you know, is able to go up and about, go grocery shopping. They can take care of themselves, but they're not really able to do regular activities. So usually not able to work, may need to take some time off of their job. ECOG of 3 is someone who spends greater than 50% of the time in the bed or chair. ECOG of 4 is somebody who is bedbound or wheelchair bound.
There were some clinical trials run in the 1970s, primarily through the SWOG group, actually, I think, the Southwestern Oncology Group. And they had looked at patients with these higher grade functional statuses, such as 3 and 4, and found that survival was actually less in patients who received chemotherapy with poor functional status. I think it's important, though, to take in mind a person's baseline status separate from what you're seeing right in front of you. And sometimes with colon cancer, you'll see patients who've had a rapid deterioration and were functioning quite well, able to do all they needed to do up until a week or two ago. But due to weight loss or fatigue due to their cancer, such as either they may now be in the ECOG 3 status. And sometimes getting a response causing the tumor to regress, you may be able to improve their functional status in a shorter period of time. And these are always difficult discussions. Usually ECOG 4 is much more straightforward, where the best benefit is going to be with your supportive care. And I think for all these patients, early involvement of your support services, such as palliative care, social work, and dietitian, helps with patient outcomes. So the goal of our treatments are going to be to prolong survival and maintain quality of life as long as possible. And all treatments should be with that in mind. Okay, so moving into the systemic therapy options for metastatic colon cancer, the bread and butter backbone in the treatments that's been part of care since the 1970s, and we have not seemed to find any better alternative to date, is 5-fluorouracil, or 5-FU. This is a really interesting chemotherapy, and I've seen it described as one molecule with two mechanisms of action. For those interested in a more detailed discussion on this drug itself, as well as capecitabine, there's some great conversations in the Oncopharm podcast. It's a pyrimidine analog, and it interferes with the synthesis of new DNA molecules via blockage of thymidylate synthetase, and also has some direct DNA incorporation effects. The way that we administer it may balance how much of either the DNA or thymidylate synthetase action takes place. And you'll hear about when we talk about our different ways of administering 5-FU is either a bolus or an infusion. This may begin as a bolus, which is as a high-dose, short-term infusion, or as an infusion, which can be given in 24-hour increments, usually in modern regimens as a 48-hour infusion.
Now, the two different mechanisms of actions also means that there's two different toxicity profiles for 5-FU. For the bolus infusion, there is a higher rate of myelosuppression and mucositis. So if you have somebody that has, you know, issues with cytopenias, you can always consider taking out the bolus of 5-FU. For the infusional 5-FU, common side effects that we see are rash, photosensitivity, and occasionally cardiac vasospasm.
Yeah, and I think that photosensitive rash is a good one to keep in mind. Where I was in Canada, people really like to soak up the sun in the summer because we don't get much of it for the rest of the year. And it was always important to remind them to make sure they have all their skin covered, wide-brimmed hats, long-sleeve shirts. It can cause quite a sunburn when people are exposed. There was great interest in the 5-FU going through the 1970s after it was initially developed. But it wasn't until 1989 that we were able to develop a regimen that did show initial survival benefits. And this is what is now known as the Mayo Clinic regimen. And this was giving a bolus of 5-FU for 5 days straight on an every 28-day cycle. This Mayo Clinic regimen was given with leucovorin, which helps increase the efficacy of the thymidylate synthetase inhibition. And in this trial, they found that the survival was increased from 7.7 months with 5-FU alone to 12 months with the 5-FU and leucovorin regimen. As we mentioned, there are a lot tougher toxicities with the bolus, and this was a relatively toxic regimen, especially with the myelosuppression and mucositis, requiring hospitalizations for infection, as well as a lot of IV hydration as well. In the subsequent years, additional trials were run to try to balance out toxicity and efficacy. And in 1997, De Grammont and colleagues compared their regimen, which was using a basal bolus regimen, which is similar to what we use today. And this was a combination of both a lower dose of a basal 5-FU and then a lower dose of a bolus 5-FU followed by a basal regimen given for 48 hours. And this was repeated every 2 weeks. They found compared to the Mayo Clinic regimen, they had similar survival, but increased the chance of response from 15% to 30%, increased progression-free survival, and had significantly decreased toxicity. And that's why most of the common modern-day regimens use this basal-bolus combination.
When we say progression-free survival, because this comes up a lot in talking about oncology clinical trials, there are numerous different endpoints that different studies use. You know, our goal is to make patients live longer, live better. So really, overall survival is the endpoint that is preferred, and that's the time from randomization in the trial to the time of death. Now, what many trials have done is looking at progression-free survival, which is the time from randomization on the study to the time of disease progression or death.
This is a composite endpoint that is based upon primarily upon what we see on CT scans.
So typically in these studies looking at PFS, when you look at the curves, it's more of like a staircase or stepwise fashion. So when they do the CTs at certain time points, you'll see a certain amount of patients fall off the curve.
Clinical trial investigators and find this a useful endpoint for them as it has increased number of events. And as we'll get into it another time, increased number of events reduces the number of patients you need and the quicker to completing a clinical trial to find efficacy. Always the question is, is progression-free survival always a surrogate for overall survival? And in some cancers, we have been able to show that in a clinical trial setting. Not always is progression-free survival a true surrogate marker of the outcomes that we care about and what our patients care about.
So it's always important to discuss this with your patient, especially if a regimen increases the progression-free survival, but not the overall survival. So occasionally you'll have a patient who you start on a 5-FU-based regimen, and the patient will have horrible side effects, severe diarrhea, mucositis, nausea, neurological changes such as ataxia, altered mental status, cardiotoxicity, so chest pain, severe coronary vasospasm, severe rash, photosensitivity, what we call hand-foot syndrome. This is classic for a deficiency called DPD deficiency. So DPD is dihydropyrimidine dehydrogenase, and this is the enzyme that metabolizes 5-FU. So you can imagine that if you have a deficiency in this enzyme, then 5-FU is hanging around a lot longer, and you'll have severe toxicities. This is not very common. Estimates have put this at less than 10% of patients. This is typically in European series. So again, not very common, but if you have somebody who has severe side effects, you would want to make sure that you check for DPD.
One last thing just on the topic of 5-fluorouracil and its analogs. We'll also be talking at times about a drug called capecitabine, which is an oral equivalent. Usually when we talk about 5-FU given as a every 2 week basal bolus regimen, this is relatively equivalent to giving capecitabine. Toxicities are slightly different. Capecitabine is more likely to cause diarrhea, more likely to cause hand-foot syndrome. And you have to keep in mind certain drug interactions such as PPI use and renal dysfunction. But otherwise, we can continue to consider those relatively equivalent.
Yeah, so as far as renal dysfunction, it's really contraindicated to use capecitabine in someone who has a creatinine clearance less than 30.
Moving on from 5-FU, many of you who have already treated colon cancer or are aware of the disease know that often we are now using doublet regimens, the so-called FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, which are named for containing a 5-FU and leucovorin, which would be the FOL as a bolus, and then 5-FU alone, which is the F component, as well as a secondary drug, which may be either oxaliplatin or irinotecan.
So getting into FOLFOX, which again is 5-FU, bolus, infusional, and oxaliplatin. Talking about oxaliplatin, so oxaliplatin is a platinum agent similar to cisplatin, however, has less ototoxicity, nephrotoxicity, requires much less IV fluid for patient or for people who are familiar with cisplatin. One of the major toxicities, which is unique to oxaliplatin, is neuropathy, cold neuropathy. So these patients have to make sure that they avoid the colds the day of the infusion and subsequently after that. They can become very sensitive to cold. So even things like reaching into the refrigerator to get something as soon as they leave the infusion center in the winter, make sure that, you know, all their skin is covered. Getting into irinotecan, which is our other agent that we use. So irinotecan is a topoisomerase inhibitor. And the major side effects of irinotecan is diarrhea. And you want to make sure that when you start them on this, they have a script for Imodium or loperamide to go home with. Also nausea, vomiting, myelosuppression.
Irinotecan also has one of these genetic polymorphisms similar to DPD and 5-FU. For irinotecan, it's the UGT1A1 polymorphism. The way irinotecan works is it's metabolized by the liver into the active metabolite SN38. And then SN38 is excreted due to this, due to the UGT enzyme. If patients are deficient in this enzyme, they'll build up their SN38, toxicities will build up, patients can have worse neutropenia. There's a overlap between the UGT1A1 polymorphism and Gilbert's disease. So if you ever see a patient with elevated bilirubin on its own, that's an important thing to look into prior to starting them on irinotecan. All right, so the doublet agents are what we now use as the standard of care, although it's really difficult going through the evidence to kind of see how that's come to be. And part of the reason is there's been different regimens over the years of using 5-FU, and in a similar manner, there's been different combination regimens. And some of the older trials that brought either irinotecan or oxaliplatin into the double agent regimens were combining it with an outdated 5-FU. Modern day FOLFOX and FOLFIRI is using the 5-FU basal bolus every 2 weeks. The best evidence we have for either using FOLFOX up front versus a patient who got 5-FU followed by oxaliplatin as a second line, in a similar manner, FOLFIRI up front versus 5-FU followed by irinotecan in the second line. And in both settings, using the modern regimens, we've consistently been able to show an improvement in progression-free survival, improvement in response rate, however similar overall survival.
Yeah, so far the evidence doesn't show that, you know, using the doublet necessarily increases overall survival compared to using these agents as a single agent and just going on to the next one when the patient progresses. However, it is still standard practice to start off with the chemotherapy doublet.
Yeah, in general, we think that improvement in response rate might lead to, you know, better outcomes for these patients, you know, sooner response, maybe sooner improvement in symptoms. And now that we're gaining more and more active treatments, having that progression-free survival prolonged and the opportunity to use more drugs on the back end, such as if someone progresses on FOLFOX, moving to FOLFIRI later on, may actually improve overall survival, which would not have been reflected in the trials given the different second-line therapies available at that time. Just a couple other regimens just you might run across when you look at the old trials. There'll be one called IFL, and that's bolus irinotecan and 5-FU, which is now, and leucovorin, which is now considered inadequate as the modern regimens have been consistently shown to be superior. And IROX, which is irinotecan and oxaliplatin given together as a bolus, which is also inferior to a 5-FU-based doublet.
Yeah, this was shown in the INT-9741, which compared IFL versus FOLFOX versus IROX. And this was one of the reasons why FOLFOX is the preferred regimen. It had an increased overall survival of 19 months.
You may be hearing this and saying, well, should I use FOLFOX or FOLFIRI first? And so have many investigators to date, and there have been some trials looking at different orders. My best understanding of the data that's available to us is that using FOLFOX first might give a slightly higher response rate, but only minimally. And in general, you can use either as your first line agent, and often these decisions are based upon patient underlying symptoms, such as if someone has baseline neuropathy, you might reach for your FOLFIRI first, or if you're concerned about diarrhea, you might reach for FOLFOX first.
Yeah, I believe this was studied in the Tornigan trial, which looked at FOLFOX followed by FOLFIRI compared with FOLFIRI by FOLFOX, which showed similar overall survival. So no difference depending on which one you use. Should be noted that with FOLFOX and FOLFIRI, if you are using the infusional 5-FU, these patients will usually require a port or some kind of access which is something that we don't usually get taught about. And when you start off as an oncology fellow, you will need to get either infusion port, which gets placed under the skin, or have them sent with a peripheral inserted central catheter PICC line, because they will be taking an infusion pump home with them for 48 hours and coming back. So cannot be given through a regular IV.
Yeah, it's really important to know what your local support services are for that. Where I trained initially, we would have home nursing or nearby nursing center help take a patient's pump off. And this could be done any day of the week. But I think where you're training, Ryan, they have to come back to the center to have the pump removed.
Yes, typically our patients have to come back, so which is why we don't start infusions on Fridays, because they would have to come back on a Sunday and most infusion centers are closed.
If two is a bit better than one, great question is three better than two? And we have in colon cancer a regimen called FOLFOXIRI. So there's many trials I've looked at this, including a Greek and Italian study, but the best ones with the largest population are the TRIBE and the TRIBE 2 trials. The initial TRIBE trial looked at using FOLFOXIRI versus FOLFIRI alone as a first-line agent. Their study did show an improvement in median overall survival from 30 versus 26 months. They did show an improvement in response rate, so the chances of having a tumor shrink went up from 40% with the doublet agent up to 60% with the triplet agent. There was always questions with this trial because not all patients on the FOLFIRI arm were followed up to get FOLFOX, and that was thought to be a flaw in the study. And that led to the TRIBE 2 trial, which used FOLFOXIRI versus FOLFIRI with a mandated secondary FOLFOX for those who progressed. This trial also used bevacizumab as a second agent. And we'll be talking about bevacizumab and the EGFR agents in more detail next episode. And the TRIBE 2 trial was once again shown to improve survival from 27 to 22 months, and this also showed a similar response rate benefit at the cost of significant toxicity in these trial patients with high rates of diarrhea, febrile neutropenia.
So when looking at these clinical trials, you know, you always want to look at the patient in front of you and see if they're someone that would have been allowed on this clinical trial. The patients on this study were, you know, very healthy, mainly ECOG 0 or 1. So these were generally very healthy, fit patients. So you want to make sure that your patient in front of you would actually fit the trial, because if someone is a little bit more frail or perhaps ECOG of 2, this probably wouldn't be the best regimen.
Yeah, that's a good point. A lot of times clinical trials are going to select for the most fit patients or the most favorable disease process. And I think this trial, one of the major criticisms is that it did this but turned it up to 11, because having seen patients receive FOLFOXIRI, and we'll get to some of the situations where we might want to use it, often that we run into very bad toxicity. And many patients I've found cannot take much more than 4 to 6 cycles of this before we need to either remove one of the agents or dose reduce. Often we'll, when I've been giving in the past, I'd anticipate giving lots of supportive care, such as IV fluids, from the get-go. And I think the question there is, if that's the case, are we really going to be increasing overall survival in the real-world population?
So I think a setting where this is commonly used, because again, I don't think most oncologists, again, I can't speak for everyone, are really using this regimen. But a situation that I have seen this used is in patients who are considered to be potentially operable. So if you want to, you know, shrink a liver met down to an operable state to try to, you know, treat somebody with curative intent. There was a higher response rate in the FOLFOXIRI group in both of these studies. So this would be a situation where you have someone with a very good performance status with perhaps resectable disease, but maybe the liver met is slightly too large that it would be a very complicated surgery. And you really want to, you know, shrink that down to possibly being operable.
One last thing before we wrap up today, just briefly on your elderly and frail patients. So a lot of patients getting diagnosed with cancer maybe have a slightly reduced performance status. They may be older than 75 years old. That may make you concerned about the toxicity of even using a doublet regimen such as FOLFOX or FOLFIRI. And I think it's important to remember, going back to what we said initially, is that using these doublets up front have not shown improved survival to 5-FU, and single F5-FU can be a very efficacious option. And then you can use those other agents as either second-line agents, and whenever we're dealing with patients who are at risk for treatment toxicity, we want to monitor them closely, be judicious with your use of IV hydration, loperamide, and once again, don't forget our support services, palliative care, dietitians, social workers.
So I think that's it for our first episode, metastatic colon cancer, first line treatments and chemotherapy. So next time we'll be talking about the targeted agents and newer treatments for metastatic colon cancer, along with some later line options. So we hope you'll join us for the next episode.
Thanks so much for listening.
For more information, follow us on Twitter at TalkingTumors, or feel free to email us at talkingabouttumors@gmail.com.
Please rate and review the podcast. We really appreciate it.
And special shout out to our friend John Kim for all of his musical talents.
And he is the composer of the music that you're hearing right now. Talking About Tumors is not medical advice.
For medical advice, please contact your own healthcare provider.
The opinions stated on this podcast are by the Ryan who said it and no one else. We have no financial disclosures, and this is done purely on our own time to the sake of our enjoyment of the field of medical oncology. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.